Our next case is Tina Davidson et al. Versus Georgia Pacific LLC et al. And our first presenter is Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent the widow and children of Cleve Davidson, who was a roofer and sheet metal worker in northern Louisiana in the 70s and 60s, died of mesothelioma. His lawsuits, two lawsuits, have given rise to this appeal, which concerns the proper standard to be followed by district courts upon an assertion of fraudulent joinder. The parties agree that this court's review of the fraudulent joinder determination, the ultimate determination by Judge Stagg, the district court, after the initial ruling by Judge Hornsby, the magistrate judge, is de novo. And so this court is really presented with a choice between the two very different approaches, followed by first the magistrate and then by the district court. This is a garden variety asbestos case. Mr. Davidson had a career in that as a roofer and sheet metal worker that, during the course of that work, exposed him to a lot of asbestos. We filed suit originally for him while he was still alive in Orleans Parish. That case was removed near the time of trial. Mr. Davidson died. We could have amended that existing federal court case to assert claims following the death. Instead, we filed a new case for his widow and children in state court. In state court, that case was removed then to federal court in the Western District. And the assertion of there was no dispute about whether the parties were diverse or non-diverse. The Davidsons are Louisiana residents. There were two defendants included this time who had not been included the first time, two local distributors of asbestos-containing products. The case was removed upon the allegation that those defendants were fraudulently joined in an effort to stay in state court. We plead guilty to the second part of that formulation, but not the first part of that formulation. And the argument was by defendants that the entire record of discovery in the first lawsuit, in which these two local distributors were not defendants, had not turned up any evidence that, in fact, Mr. Davidson worked with products distributed by these two local Louisiana defendants. Our answer to that argument about fraudulent joinder was those companies were not defendants in the first suit. There was no discovery taken specifically as to them. The factual dispute really centered on Mr. Davidson's work for 6 years at a company called Poulan Chainsaw. He had been deposed twice while he was alive, and in the first deposition, he was asked about the possibility of exposure there, and we contended that these distributors might well have supplied insulation.
Fisher and Graves were the chainsaw.
I'm sorry?
That was the company that Taylor and Graves,
that we say they distributed products to, that he would have worked around on that job site.
Chainsaw.
Yes. And
which he said could very likely have been something he breathed.
That's right. And then in his second deposition, they asked him, do you remember working around insulation at Poulan Chainsaw? And he said no. Classic conflicting deposition testimony.
Well, in the first deposition, he said he might have been exposed at that facility, but he was talking about machinery. Where is there any indication that he was around asbestos installation?
I think the exact quotation from the deposition is found in both opinions by both judges, but Judge Hornsby quotes it, and the question, I believe, I can't remember the exact wording of the question, but the question talks about insulation. And I don't think there was any question that he was around asbestos insulation at Poulan Chainsaw. The question was whether, I don't think there's been any contention that the insulation wouldn't have been asbestos. The question was he around insulation at that job site? And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't find the exact quote. Well, all right, yeah, here we go. The first deposition. Okay, do you have any reason to believe that you were exposed to any asbestos or asbestos-contained products when you worked for Poulin between 1972 or so to 1978 or 79? Answer, it's a possibility. So that question specifically did reference asbestos-containing insulation. Judge Horn?
Involved on the trial court level?
No, Your Honor.
I'm wondering what change that caused the new lawsuit to include these two additional defendants.
Because we decided that, and not necessarily saying this was the right decision in hindsight, but I think the thinking of the lawyer handling the case was we would be better off in state court in Bossier Parish. The opportunity to file a second, we had filed the original case in state court. We had been removed. Then Mr. Davidson died, and the question at that point was, do we continue in federal court in New Orleans, or we had the opportunity to file a new lawsuit in state court. In order to try to stay in state court, we sued two local defendants. And that, of course, in hindsight,
any evidence developed that things changed, that now we have evidence against these two defendants, so we're going to add them to the case? Or is it like you're just saying we want to stay in state court, so we added them?
Nothing had changed. There was no new evidence. But again, no discovery had been taken regarding those two defendants. It's these defendants' contention, essentially, that since they weren't mentioned in the first lawsuit, therefore, perforce, fraudulent joinder of these defendants has been established. It's our contention that that is not the case, that the absence of evidence developed in one lawsuit in which those companies were not the focus of any discovery.
So why weren't they sued in the initial lawsuit?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't deny at all that it was a tactical decision to sue them in the second suit. The entire point, essentially, of the defense brief is that there's something wrong with that, and that it's forum manipulation, or they devote several pages to the notion of misconduct. If you really boil down their contention, what their contention is that Judge Stagg, who focused very heavily on the fact that these two local defendants had not been sued the first time, Judge Stagg said, it's clear the plaintiffs simply sued these defendants to stay in state court in the second lawsuit. Again, guilty as charged. And
you've got to have a basis for, a good faith basis for believing there's a claim. And why not add them? If this deposition testimony, his first deposition, in your view, provides evidence that he was exposed to insulation at this facility, why not add him? Why not add these defendants in the state suit after that deposition? But it went on for months and months without adding them in that first.
Perhaps we should have, Your Honor. There's no, I don't dispute that. Perhaps we should have, but I don't believe it at all establishes that they were fraudulently joined the second time around. And
so, what is the contention now? That how are they liable?
The contention is that they were regular, well-known, long-time distributors of asbestos-containing products in Louisiana, in northern Louisiana, and they would have likely sold insulation to the job sites Mr. Davidson worked on specifically, or most particularly, Poulin Chainsaw, where he worked for 6 years. And again, the court's fraudulent joinder jurisprudence is really mostly about cases in which, to take the example of a case that defendants sent in their 28J letter on Friday, which I sent in a response yesterday asking the court to disregard because it only cited very older cases, but actually now I'd like to talk about one of them. It's a typical case it's a case sort of exemplifying the way the court typically asks that district courts handle this question. It's the Michaels case, and it's emblematic of a certain species of case involving claims against a out-of-state insurance company and a local adjuster. And your honors know that or alleged adjuster. And your honors know that's a very, you know, typical fact pattern in these kinds of cases. And in that case, there was an uncontradicted affidavit from the local defendant engineer that I did the following kinds of things, I didn't do these kinds of things, therefore I was not an adjuster, and therefore that brings me under the very clear Texas law that only adjusters can be sued and not engineers. I was an engineer, not an adjuster. There's nothing like that in this case. There's nothing from these defendants. These defendants never once filed a piece of paper saying we've reviewed our sales records and we show no evidence of asbestos sales to Poulan Chainsaw. I really doubt that's the case because they were prominent, long-time, established asbestos product distributors. And, you know, the court can draw whatever inference it wants to draw from their not having filed any such proof of the kind the local defendant filed in Michaels.
So but there is some possibility of recovery.
Exactly.
That there's no legal defense or factually.
It's very important.
As weak as the case might be, there's a possibility that you could recover.
Exactly.
There is some liability here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is exactly our argument.
Losing summary judgment, but maybe on remand removal issue, you might succeed.
That's right. That is precisely the contention, and that's exactly how Judge Hornsby saw it. And we submit that is exactly what Smallwood, which is the seminal case, the en banc seminal case on how district courts should go about resolving these issues, says. That, you know, typically we just look at the pleadings to see if there is a cause of action cognizable that is stated in the plaintiff's complaint. There is a limited subset of cases in the Smallwood court's term, hopefully few in number, in which it is appropriate to go beyond the pleadings and resolve issues of fact, typically such as where the local defendant can introduce uncontradicted proof. The example the Smallwood court gives is, because this is another typical species of case, you sue the out-of-state pharmaceutical manufacturer, and to stay in state court, you sue the local pharmacist. And the pharmacist looks through its records and says, we have no record of this, of dispensing any drugs to this person. That is the kind of uncontradicted, easily resolvable fraudulent joinder claim. And courts are perfectly entitled to look at that kind of evidence. But here, what you've got, you don't have anything like that from these defendants. Instead, and again, we're not simply resting on the mere non-existence of their affirmative proof. Of course, we have to step back and remember this. It's defendant's burden to prove fraudulent joinder. It is a heavy burden. It is a burden they must carry with clear and convincing evidence. We're not resting alone on their utter failure to prove that. We pointed to the deposition testimony of Mr. Davidson. Is it the world's greatest testimony? No, it's not. Is it pretty thin? Yes. Are they going to file a motion for summary judgment in state court if the case is remanded? Probably so. Will we win it? I don't know, but of course we'll get to do discovery about that, and maybe we'll ask them for their sales records, and maybe they'll review them, and if they in fact have evidence that their product was never used at Poulan Chainsaw, which would be unlikely, but if they have such evidence, they'll produce it. They didn't produce it here. Instead,
there's this procedural issue which the magistrate issues a ruling. It goes to the district court, Judge Stagg, and he treated it as a non-dispositive motion and reviewed it under a clearly erroneous standard. I think all the courts of appeals view it the other way and said he should have just reviewed it de novo because it's a dispositive motion, but there is that split out there. If Judge Stagg was right and this was non-dispositive and he should have just reviewed it for clearly erroneous, which he did, doesn't that affect our standard of review? Because then wouldn't we just be reviewing the magistrate essentially under a clearly erroneous standard?
I believe that we would take the position that as it was a determination of subject matter jurisdiction, it has to be reviewed by this court de novo. I mean, the merits of the fraudulent joinder contention have to be reviewed by this court de novo. And again, what you've got is you've got two.
So you don't think we have to clearly, I mean, it seems to me it helps you if the magistrate's determination has to be reviewed under this more deferential standard.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. Yes, I mean, right. We would argue.
We would essentially be the second level of appellate review.
Correct.
Non-dispositive.
That is correct. We did not assert that as a point. Perhaps we should have, but that is correct. I misunderstood that question. So I'd like to say in what time I have left, well, I see I've got 2 seconds left, so I'll unless the court has any questions, I'll save this last point for rebuttal.
Ms. Ross?
May it please the court. My name is Valerie Ross, and I represent one of the appellees, Certainty Corporation. But I'm here today to speak on behalf of all of the appellees, and I will specifically address two issues. First, I'm going to address the appropriateness of Judge Stagg's decision to pierce the pleadings. And second, I will address the improper joinder of Taylor and Graves, as shown by matters outside the pleadings. Mr. Radiker, who represents J. Graves Insulation, is here to address any questions the court may have about whether appellants properly preserve their appeal of Judge Stagg's dismissal of Taylor and Graves. Turning first to the decision to pierce the pleadings, appellants' arguments as to the standard of review, let me back up for a second. Appellants argue in their opening brief that that decision was improper. There's a section of their brief that's very clear. But in their reply brief, they seem to concede that the district court could properly consider matters outside the pleadings, and specifically, it was appropriate for the district court to consider what had happened in the first lawsuit, the deposition testimony of Mr. Davidson, the discovery that went on, which of course is only appropriate if you in fact pierce the pleading. So it's not really clear to me at this point whether they are continuing to stress the point that it was improper somehow to pierce the pleadings or not. But to the extent they are, I want to pause over the standard of review. Mr. Siegel said that Judge Stagg's rulings in their entirety are reviewed de novo. But in fact, his decision to pierce the pleadings is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And I think, Judge Costa, to answer the question that you asked at the very end, is whether the Judge Stagg should have reviewed Magistrate Judge Hornsby's decision for clear error versus de novo. And I think what makes that even more complicated is the difference in their approach. And Judge Stagg's approach was very different. He decided that it was appropriate to pierce the pleadings. And once he did that, this court's jurisprudence is clear that that decision is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And that's come straight from Smallwood and the Gilroy case, which we cited in our Rule 28J letter. Makes that clear as well. And appellants never argue, much less demonstrate anywhere, that Judge Stagg ever abused his discretion when he decided to pierce the pleadings. Appellants also seem to suggest that the type of case matters, both for improper joinder generally and specifically in connection with a decision to pierce the pleadings. And they take the position that this is a garden variety dispute. I think Mr. Siegel said that to you during his argument, concerning whether Taylor Graves supplied insulation to Poulon Chainsaw and whether then Mr. Davidson was exposed to that insulation. And in those circumstances, it's never appropriate to pierce the pleadings. But there's nothing in this court's jurisprudence to suggest such a limitation on the kinds of cases when a court can exercise its discretion to look behind the pleadings. And facts that may demonstrate there's no reasonable basis to predict that you might be able to recover from the in-state defendant, those can exist in any type of case, and it's our position that they exist here. And in fact, that this case presents a clear situation involving forum manipulation. Now, appellees agree that the motives of appellants in deciding to sue Taylor and Graves don't matter. You can sue a non-diverse defendant solely because you don't want to get into federal court. But you can't avoid federal court by suing such a defendant when you have no hope of any recovery from them, and you know that. And viewed in the light of the history of the first lawsuit, the discovery record in that case, the status of that case, that's what happened here.
But in that first case, your two clients weren't part of that lawsuit, so there was no discovery with regard to the two defendants that were added later on. How do we know whether they were liable or not, if you want to say? I mean, they weren't part of the discovery.
My client was a part of that first lawsuit, Your Honor, as were all of the appellees here but for Taylor and Graves. Mm-hmm. And The reason we know is because of the questions were asked, right? There's two pieces to the claim against Taylor and Graves that are sort of at issue here. One is, did they have anything to do with Poulan Chainsaw? Did they supply any insulation? Did they do any work on insulation at Poulan Chainsaw? And then the second question is, was Mr. Davidson exposed to any asbestos as a result of their activities, right? Both of those facts are predicates to a claim against Taylor and Graves. And while there might not have been a whole lot of discovery or questioning in the first case about Taylor and Graves specifically because they weren't parties to the first lawsuit, the defendants in that first lawsuit, including my client, were very interested in the answer to the second question because in an asbestos-related case, that sort of alternative exposure evidence, that's the holy grail for a defendant. I would be delighted to be able to stand up in front of a jury or in a motion for summary judgment and argue it wasn't Mr. Davidson's exposure to my client that caught my client's products that caused his disease. It was this other exposure, his exposure to insulation. And even if I'm unsuccessful in making that kind of a sole proximate cause argument, I still have the opportunity to argue liability has to be shared, right? Any verdict in this case has to be allocated on the wrongful death claim, on a survival claim. In Louisiana, it's going to be allocated pro rata. I can get non-parties on the verdict sheet. I want to know, and that's why Mr. Davidson was asked those questions about insulation at Poulan. It was defendant's counsel. I believe it was an attorney representing Certainty Corporation at his deposition in June 2011 that asked Mr. Davidson the specific questions about, were you exposed to insulation? That's why we wanted to know the answer to that question. And so it was a very important fact for us that was explored.
And he said?
He said no. He was asked in June 2011, do you remember anyone doing any work with insulation at Poulan Chainsaw? No. He was also asked, do you recall?
So he didn't say he didn't. He said he did not remember.
Well, he said no to the question, do you remember seeing anyone doing any work with insulation?
Right.
And the answer to that question was no.
No. And the question was, do you remember?
I mean, that was perhaps inartful phrasing, but the answer was no.
No, he does not remember. That doesn't mean it did not happen.
Well, but he also answered that he did not recall seeing any insulation at Poulan Chainsaw, seeing any pipe insulation at Poulan Chainsaw. So where was the insulation, this sort of phantom insulation?
And without discovery, we don't know.
Well, but there was discovery.
With regard to these two that were added later on.
But there was discovery with respect to the question
to the
of
others.
Insulation. And there was also, in addition to the deposition testimony, there were also interrogatories that were asked and that were responded to by plaintiffs, including master interrogatories that asked the plaintiffs, Mr. Davidson, to describe all of the locations where you were exposed to asbestos. Tell us every place you were exposed. Tell us every product to which you were exposed to. Tell us the years. Tell us what you were doing. Poulan Chainsaw, never mentioned in the response to that discovery. And this case was removed, the first lawsuit, Mr. Davidson's lawsuit, was removed to federal court in April 2011. That discovery that I'm referring to was responded to in June 2010. Whatever the Louisiana rules may be on the duty to supplement, after April 2011, under Rule 26, if Mr. Davidson or his lawyers believed that there was some exposure that he may have had to insulation at Poulan Chainsaw, they were obligated to supplement that discovery, and they never did. Instead, they brought this new lawsuit.
How many workers had no idea they were breathing something that would cause their death?
Your Honor, I don't know.
How many times did that happen? How many thousands of times did it happen? And they just don't know when it was or where it was. So all he can say is, very likely. He didn't just say no. He said, yeah, it was very likely.
Your Honor, what he said was very,
that's a little something. And it certainly is enough to give the plaintiff an opportunity for development of what Taylor and Graves actually sold and what was manufactured during those years, which they weren't doing in that case.
Your Honor,
not a friendly question.
I recognize that, Your Honor, but I will nonetheless try and answer. I don't know the answer to your first question, but as to the second question, or Mr. Davidson's deposition testimony, at his first deposition, he was not asked about insulation. He was asked, is it Were you exposed to asbestos or asbestos-containing products during the time you worked at Poulan Chainsaw? Insulation not mentioned in that question. That's the question to which he answered, very possible or it's possible. But asbestos and asbestos-containing products does not necessarily mean insulation. There are hundreds, thousands of asbestos-containing products out there that were sold and manufactured over the years that were not insulation. My client is not in this case because of insulation. Other than Taylor and Graves, they're the only two defendants that are in this case because of alleged exposure to asbestos-containing insulation. And so the answer that at Poulan Chainsaw I might have been exposed to asbestos tells you nothing about was that asbestos-containing insulation. And the only allegation in the petition or in the complaint against allegations against Taylor and Graves relate to insulation. They are not alleged to be responsible for any other product, any other asbestos exposures. The complaint against them is based on alleged exposure to asbestos-containing insulation at Poulan Chainsaw. Mr. Davidson, I agree with you, people may not know they were exposed to something, but they know whether or not usually they worked with a product. That is a predicate to liability. Did you ever work with or around this product? And if you can't say that, then you're going to have problems. Then you're not going to be held responsible. The exposure question, that's usually a question for an expert. But he didn't get over the, did you work with the product, what I would call the product identification question. He answered that no.
But the first deposition, it is a more general question. It doesn't mention insulation, but it says asbestos-containing products, which would include, among the many hundreds of things, insulation. So why isn't there a discrepancy in the two depositions that has to be resolved in his favor?
Because it's entirely consistent with the notion that he was exposed to an asbestos-containing product and then his testimony that, no, I was not exposed to insulation. You've sort of taken a very high level of generality and now you've narrowed it down to the very specific. And so that leaves the possibility that he was exposed to asbestos-containing gaskets, packings, you name it, in terms of other asbestos-containing products. But his answer at the second deposition, no to the I didn't see insulation, I wasn't around people doing work with insulation, that takes insulation out of the asbestos-containing products bucket that he sort of said there was some possibility of at the first deposition. Now, a few other facts relating to the first lawsuit that I think are relevant. We've talked about his deposition testimony. I think Your Honors noted the fact that Mr. Davidson didn't sue Taylor and Graves in that first lawsuit. But it's also significant that Mr. Davidson's petition in Orleans Parish, it disclaimed any asbestos exposure after 1972. And that's important because 1972, that's the year that Mr. Davidson first started working at Poulan Chainsaw, which again is the location of the exposure. And that's the petition is in the Record on Appeal at page 841. And indeed, the petition in Orleans Parish alleges Mr. Davidson's exposure to asbestos while working at various facilities, various employers, there's a list of both. Poulan Chainsaw is not listed among either one of those groups. And moreover, Mr. Davidson wasn't parsimonious in naming defendants in that first lawsuit. He sued 21 defendants in Orleans Parish, including a different Louisiana-based insulation contractor, a competitor of Taylor and Graves, Eagle. Eagle was the only non-diverse defendant in that first lawsuit filed in Orleans Parish, and it was after the state court granted Eagle's unopposed motion for summary judgment in April of 2011, 11 months after the case was filed, that the first lawsuit was successfully removed to federal court, to the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And further, it's also interesting that Mr. Davidson didn't sue Poulan Chainsaw in the first lawsuit, and appellants didn't sue Poulan Chainsaw here. Now, Mr. Davidson was an employee of Poulan Chainsaw, but workers' compensation would not have been a bar to recovery from Poulan Chainsaw because under the Louisiana Workers' Compensation Act, mesothelioma is not listed as an occupational disease until 1975. And so to the extent your asbestos exposures occurred prior to then, you can sue your employer without any bar from the workers' compensation statute. Given sort of the litigation history, given the discovery, given the fact that the case was on the verge of trial, it was actually twice on the verge of trial, so it was fully discovered, in Orleans Parish, 11 months of discovery. It was set for trial in May 2011. That trial date got bumped to June 2011 during the same hearing when Eagle's unopposed motion for summary judgment was granted. And then it got removed. It's in federal court for a while. March 2012, the court in the Eastern District of Louisiana sets a trial date of January 2013. All that plaintiffs needed to do at that point, or all that appellants here needed to do, was substitute themselves in for Mr. Davidson, who had since passed away. They didn't do that. The case was ready for trial, fully discovered. All the information was out there. As I said, it was defendants wanted to know about insulation. We cared about learning everything we could about all of Mr. Davidson's exposures. And yet, nothing mentioned in the first lawsuit. And it was certainly within Judge Stagg's discretion to consider all that. And I submit that he appropriately credited what had happened in the first lawsuit in deciding that there was no realistic possibility of recovery against Taylor and Graves. And further, against this backdrop of this fully developed factual record, additional discovery about Taylor and Graves wouldn't have made any difference. They wouldn't have learned anything. And it's important, though, to keep in mind, as I said, that the defendants had every incentive. That's why.
Why wouldn't they have learned if they supplied this facility during the 72 to 78?
Because even had they, Mr. Davidson had denied that he was exposed to any insulation.
Can't you get other workers to testify about whether there was, where the insulation was during that time period?
They thought there were other workers out there. They should have offered some affidavit or something in connection with the motion to remand. And that was sort of.
But until they get the employee records and all those other things, they don't even know how to track these people down.
Well, you know, they can, you know.
The burden.
They could have.
The burden is on defendants.
But, Your Honor, under the Gilroy case and the Michaels case, and there's other decisions from the Fifth Circuit, the burden shifts, right? Once the defendants came forth with evidence establishing that there was no likelihood or no reasonable possibility of recovery against Taylor and Graves, the appellants were required to do something in response. They couldn't then rest on what they had said in their complaint. We had showed that the complaint misstated the allegation that Mr. Davidson was exposed to insulation at Poulan Chainsaw. We offered his testimony where he denied that exposure. We submitted the entirety of the discovery record. And appellants came back with nothing. And if they thought some discovery would have helped, they could have taken that discovery. Smallwood allows for discovery on an improper joinder thing. It's limited. You know, it's not going to be full case discovery, but they could have asked. We need the opportunity to serve some limited request for production on Taylor and Graves so we can see if they have any sales records. We need the opportunity to take a 30B6 deposition of Taylor and Graves so we can see what they know. Will they acknowledge that they supplied something? Because maybe had they come up with that evidence, maybe that would have been enough. It would be a very different case than what we have right now, where all of the facts were submitted by the defendants, the appellees here, and the appellants, all they rest on is the deposition testimony, which we submit is not in conflict, is pretty clear, and that's it. And you know, they put in below an affidavit from their lawyer, which Judge Stagg rightly declined to consider because it was based on hearsay and was speculative. So I see my time is up. If there's no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you
very much.
Well, Mr. Radiker has a couple of minutes. Unless you want to concede your minutes to him, which I don't think you do.
No, Your Honor. H. Philip Radiker, Jr. for the J. Graves Insulation Company, and for this argument also Taylor Seidenbach. Basically, Your Honors, Rule 3 is a jurisdictional rule, and the court below issued two separate orders. The first one, it was a denial of the remand plus all the claims against Graves and Taylor were dismissed with prejudice. The second order that the court issued was on the Daubert motions, which were granted to several of the defendants in this case. Those are being ignored, of course, by the appellants. And there were motions for summary judgment, which were granted to some of those defendants. And in their first notice of appeal, they went to that second July 2014 order and designated at that time only the motions for summary judgment ruling, ignoring the Dauberts. That, later that afternoon, a second notice of appeal came out designating the, and this was the April now, court ruling, designating the denial of the plaintiff's motion to demand and ignoring the dismissals of Graves and Taylor. And so mainly all we're doing, Your Honor, is saying that it's a jurisdictional rule. They needed to designate, I kind of call it a swing and a miss. Maybe they wanted to, they didn't. And so with that, there is no jurisdiction for the dismissal of Graves and Taylor under Rule 3. And that's basically what my argument is, and I have about 12 seconds. Any questions on that?
No questions.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly on the notice of appeal issue. That issue, we say in our reply brief, was waived. They mentioned it in the statement of jurisdiction, said nothing about it in the body of the brief, didn't brief that argument at all. We said it was waived. If you want to get to the merits of that issue, we feel that that the obvious import, as Judge Stagg stated himself, of the fraudulent joinder ruling was equivalent to granting summary judgment in favor of Taylor and Graves. There could be no possible confusion about what the notice of appeal was intended to accomplish or to appeal. On the merits of the fraudulent joinder issue, we've been spending this argument parsing Mr. Davidson's two depositions and talking a lot about what happened in the first lawsuit. And we asked the court to step back and see, I think, that this is not really what district courts are supposed to be doing. There was no undisputed, easily establishable, uncontroverted fact that the defendants put forward. Appellee's counsel said several times that once we came forward with evidence of fraudulent joinder, the burden shifted to plaintiffs to controvert it. They didn't ever come forward with that evidence. They came forward with a lot of argument about what conclusions should be drawn from the prior litigation history. Now, in their brief, there's a lot of, it's suffused with a contention that all of that amounted to misconduct. I don't think they're pursuing that, or she didn't pursue that theme here today, but we certainly deny that it was misconduct. We have discussed in our reply brief why it is not at all like the Tedford case, which was the only case they cited in their appellee's brief on misconduct. But what they came forward with was, gee, Judge, you ought to draw conclusions from the history of the first lawsuit that the plaintiffs don't really have any evidence against these two companies. And that is not the kind of evidence that this court has sustained findings of fraudulent joinder on.
What do we do with, was it your client that said he was not exposed to anything after 1972?
That was apparent. That is an argument that I'm not familiar with, Your Honor. I don't believe it appears in their appellee's brief, but if there was a disclaimer as to that effect in the first lawsuit, there was no such disclaimer in the second lawsuit. And he was questioned about asbestos exposure at his deposition. And he testified that there was, and by the way, you can be assured that the defendants would completely have ignored that disclaimer in the trial of the case and would have pointed to all of his exposure throughout his entire life. So I think they're asking you to set out a rule that fraudulent joinder can be based upon a judge's subjective conclusions about what happened in prior litigation in which the now sued local defendants were not parties. What would that rule look like? It certainly would run afoul of Smallwood's dictates that we don't pierce the pleadings unless there's some kind of easily established objective fact that the defendant puts forward. If the defendant puts forward an affidavit that I wasn't an adjuster, I was an engineer, then it's up to the plaintiff to controvert that. Should we have conducted some discovery in this case? Yes, perhaps in hindsight, we should have asked for a deposition of Graves and the other local defendant. By the way, again, there's still never been any assertion in this case by those two defendants that they did not supply asbestos to this facility.
Is your problem so much that the court considered the earlier lawsuit? I mean, it seems to me evidence is evidence. If that could be used at trial in the second lawsuit, it's evidence a court can generally consider. So is your problem that there's just some blanket rule against considering a different lawsuit, or is it that you don't think the record, even from that lawsuit, meets
It's really both. It's really both, because that record is not evidence of anything. All you can draw, the only actual fact established from that record is the two sentences that are focused on in this appeal in his two different depositions. There was no evidence, yay or nay, about these two defendants in that.
But the depositions we can consider.
Yes, yes.
They'd be admissible in the second.
Absolutely. We don't contend they wouldn't be admissible, and the jury could draw whatever conclusions it wanted to draw from that testimony. Thank you, Your Honor. Unless there are any further questions, that'll be. Thanks.
Thank you all.